You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Maybe the Earth is actually moving, right? And then they changed their kind of mathematical formulas and realized this explains all those anomalous things much better than that idea that the Earth is the center, the stable center of the universe. And so the term Copernican revolution is used. It's kind of a cliche. I mean, it's a catchphrase. Any kind of revolution, any kind of change in thought which fundamentally transforms what you thought was just taken for granted, obvious. Everybody knows this, okay? And you have to think about how traumatic that would be to all of a sudden realize the Earth isn't the center of the universe. Yeah?
When you say the Earth was the center, that was Ptolemy, right?
Yeah.
When was that?
Ptolemy?
When did that idea come about, the Earth was the center?
Roman, Yeah, but I mean, Ptolemy was like...
I was just trying to see how far back that idea
started. Ancient world. Second? No. I'm on thin ice. I can't tell you. I can look it up. Right. But it's a Ptolemaic view, right? But it's a geocentric view, right? And it fit really well, okay? Once you challenge that, right? I mean, so I'm trying to get students to think about what would be the equivalent of that? Well, I guess obviously be like, well, we think, you know, we know what life is made out of, right? So we're looking at Mars. We're sending out space exploration. Am I okay?
Oh,
moving too much? Okay. Trying to, you know, find life, right? What are the assumptions that go on about life? What do we always look for when we're looking for life? Right, or science, right, water flows, ice, something like that. You'd be like realizing water's not the essence of life. There's something else you were overlooking all along, right? That's the real explanation for life, right? And that's in all these things which we never thought there would be life. I mean, it didn't have that impact, but, you know, they found those extreme forms of life at the oceanic rifts, high pressure, high intense, and very hot, you know, water being, you know, steamed by the center of the Earth, right? There's all kinds of organisms living there. No one thought life could live there. That didn't really challenge us, right? But it'd be like finding there's intelligent life, not out there, but it's like right around us and we didn't know it. Okay? I'm not getting this to you. Right? Well, here's another example. I mean, it's a bad example, but I just read about it. There's something called cryptochromes that are proteins on the retina. I just read this two nights ago. And birds have cryptochromes, fruit flies have cryptochromes, so do human beings. But fruit flies and birds actually can visualize magnetic fields. Right? And they're fine, and they did this experiment, they knocked out the gene which expresses for cryptochromes in fruit flies, and they couldn't navigate, right? Then they took human DNA, the genetic sequence in humans which produces cryptochromes, and they bred it back into the fruit flies, and they could navigate, right? So all it'd be like saying, you know, well, I don't know. That's not that great example. But, I mean, if you could all of a sudden visualize magnetic fields, right? I mean, it's like it just changes everything, right? But that one about the center of the universe, I mean, it challenges the physical world. It challenges kind of the religious understanding. So that was going on, right? And a lot of the founders were deep into that, especially Franklin, Ben Franklin. He was the first American inducted into the Royal Society in England, right? Experimenting, trying to find things out. The Reformation, again, was a big, big factor. 16th century... Luther and Calvin challenged the Catholic Church and its authority. Remember Luther's byword, every man should be... Any of you know this? You know your... Luther said, you know, he tacked up his 95 theses and challenged the authority of the Church, and he said, we don't need to listen to the Vatican. We certainly don't need to listen to this corrupt entity. Every man should be his own priest, mm-hmm. Right? The Bible should be published in the vernacular, whatever language you speak. You should be able to read the Bible. You should be able to make up your mind, right? And you know what happened, right? I mean, all of a sudden everybody said, oh, now we all know what the Bible means, right? No, you know, we had like schisms and fragmentation and, you know, denomination after denomination after denomination, right? And Luther himself, you know, really thought things got out of hand. I mean, he was the one who urged people to put down peasant uprisings, the Swabian uprising, right? And they were using the same rhetoric he used to challenge the church, right? And he's like, wait a minute, stab, smite, or slay, these are rebels, right? I mean, the Protestant Reformation had a tremendously disruptive impact on what people expected and what people took for granted. And then you had all the political revolutions, mainly fought around religious ideas in the 17th century. So the point I'm getting at, it was a very tumultuous period that gave birth to the Enlightenment. Okay. And the Enlightenment is one way to respond to all of this. There's lots of different ways, and I think some are actually more intuitive. So one way to respond to all this upheaval is just to become a thoroughgoing skeptic. Right? I mean, if we thought the Earth was the center of the universe, now we know the Sun is the center of the universe, but now we know there's other solar systems out there. Right? Now we know there's other galaxies out there. It's like, well, how do we ever know that anything we believe is really true? Right? And a lot of people at the time did revert to skepticism. It was a kind of revival of skepticism where basically you can't know. Right? You go with hunches, you go with probabilities, and that's as good as it gets. But that's a really pessimistic concept for a lot of people. Right? I mean, there is no certainty. Right? There's no ultimate truth. There's no real answer to these questions. We'll never know that the things we believe are true. We'll always have to sort of have that kind of tenuous grasp of those kinds of claims. So that's one way to respond, right? And a lot of people that were skeptics became conservatives. They just sort of went back and said, let's just go with what worked. Go with the Catholic Church, right? Let's go with humoral theory, right? We don't want these people taking apart human bodies and finding fallopian tubes and You know, things we didn't know about. Let's just sort of go back with what we were comfortable with, because we have no guarantee the new stuff is going to be true. Okay. Classical conservatism is an important response, and Edmund Burke is the main figure here. But Edmund Burke wrote about the French Revolution. He supported the American Revolution because he thought it was a continuation of the British kind of rights and values. But the French Revolution, he thought was going to be a disaster before it became the Reign of Terror. And he wrote the famous book, Reflections on the Revolution in France. And his claim was, really, these ideas about standing on your own and thinking for yourself are fundamentally dangerous. Right? His claim was, I don't place much stock in most people's ability to reason. Right? And some people, like me, right, the natural aristocracy, right, but most people are not reasonable. Most people are passionate. Right? And you start toppling traditions, challenging beliefs, right? Most people are not going to respond rashly. They're going to become very dangerous and very erratic, and you have no idea how it's going to turn out, right? So that's a classical conservative position. Burke thought we should treat traditions with respect and awe, right? We should almost sort of have a reverence towards tradition. Like, for example, as the British attitude toward royalty. It's still pretty strong, right? But everything else can be, even the punk rockers were sort of like, you know, you don't make fun of the queen, right? I mean, you can make fun of everything else, but, you know, there's certain traditions you have to hold dear. That's a classical conservative position, right? But that point of view really challenged the whole idea of modernity, right? Individual rights, individual freedom, individual rationality, capitalism when it came along. Those conservatives were very critical of free market capitalism, right? They thought it's going to unleash people's passions, right? Everybody can acquire wealth. Everybody can strive to have more. Everybody can improve their lot in life. They were very fearful of that. Okay, so classical conservatives' response was, we need to recognize we're all not the same. There's a natural aristocracy. They should have greater political authority than the rest of us. Okay? And we should really work to maintain our traditions, and that also includes a public religion, right? Because that's the one thing which really cement respect for these kind of institutions we have, is you can sort of maintain kind of a religious foundation for them, right? So that's one response. Everybody's good? Okay. The other response, the more enlightened response, is to face up to that skepticism and really push on it and push on it and push on it until you find something found, something sound to sort of build on, right? And then slowly start building up from that kind of that process of going through doubt. And the most famous figure here is the 17th century philosopher René Descartes. Any of you familiar with his Meditations on First Philosophy? Excuse me, let me say dinner. You may, when I start talking about it, you may get this. I mean, this is where Descartes was basically trying to figure out what we could really understand and know and claim to be true, right? So he subjected everything he believed to doubt. Everything. Okay? Starting with his, well, they got there eventually, right? But first he starts with, like right now, I'll go through it, right? This could be a dream. You've all had dreams, right? Dreams seem real. You wake up terrified. When you're in the dream, it seems real. How do I know this isn't a dream? This is a nightmare. How do I know, right? You don't, right? So you have to say, okay, this all could be an illusion, right? You have to accept that moment, that bit of doubt, because it may be a dream, right? You could wake up, okay? Your senses have all, you've all been deceived by your senses, right? Right? You thought you heard something, you thought you saw something, you thought you smelled something. Smell you don't get messed up with. But then what did you make mistakes on, right? Right? But you've all been sort of caught up, right? So all of our senses are suspect too. Right? They could be misleading us, right? You have to put those aside. The idea of a God, right? He famously said, we have to assume that God maybe isn't the great good God, right? God may be a great jokester who's just presenting all this as a big joke, right? To sort of mess with us, okay? So he accepted that, and he got all the point of his own existence, right? But then his claim was, even if I'm wrong about my existence, if I'm thinking about my existence, I exist. I may have any idea what my life is about or what I'm about, right? But that was like the anchor he found, right? Was even if you're thinking, you exist, and you know that for certain, right? And if you read the book, then he makes like, then all of a sudden, all the skepticism goes out, and it's like, oh, well then God is good, our senses are real, and he builds back up, right? But the point is, he pushed and pushed and pushed on that skepticism until he found something he could stand on, and then said, we have to be very careful and methodical in building back up to claims which we can actually know, right? Constantly go back and check and see if we're assuming something, like the earth is the center of the universe, right? Question that. Doubt that. See if it would make more sense if the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. Okay. Yeah.
So basically, his motto was, when in doubt, skepticize.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's kind of a radical skeptic, and Hume was as well, later, 18th century.
In this context, what's the difference between just having skepticism and facing skepticism?
Well, I guess I was going to mean, you never can be sure, right? And you become almost despair. It's like, how do we know? How do we know, right? And you sort of wallow in that despair, and you can go either way, but you can also become reactionary conservative, right? Just because it worked, and that's the only reason you hang on to it. Not out of a reverence like birth, right? But just because, oh my God, if we start doing genetic research, you know, we could have, human organs developed in pigs, which we're working on right now. I mean, who knows what it'll lead to, right? Let's just go back to the humerals, the humeral medicine. And that's just kind of a despair. A skeptical despair. That's what I was trying to get at with that first one. This one is kind of, they would say this, right? I'm not saying, right? This is more courageous, though. It's like, okay, we'll deal with the skepticism and we'll sort of rub our nose in it, right, until we find something we can believe in and then slowly kind of build up gradually, carefully, so we don't get fooled again. That's a Who song. That's kind of the motto. It's like, we don't want to get fooled again, right? We don't want to, life is this, and then realize, no, life's not that. Or the sun is the center of the universe, and you realize, no, there's many, many solar systems, right? And there's many, many forms of life out there. So to avoid that, Descartes really is the one who said, you have to deal with the skepticism and doubt everything, everything, okay? And then try to sort of find something you can hang on to and build back up, okay? Good question, though, right? Does that make sense? I mean, just imagine how people would respond, people you know, especially older people, right, with some big scientific breakthrough, right? They're not like, always, yeah, right? It's kind of like, oh, God, It's like, oh, I mean, I don't want to learn this stuff. It's going to disrupt everything, right? And there's that skepticism, which is kind of almost a despair about these kind of transformations, right? So that's one response, and it was pretty prevalent. Okay. All right. Everybody's good? Okay. This is Immanuel Kant. Famous statement, late 18th century, about the time of the about the time of the Constitution. About what the Enlightenment really is. And this is like probably the most famous statement about the Enlightenment. I'm going to throw a lot of quotes up, so I'm just going to try to slow down and let you read them instead of me. So, okay. But think about the key words there.
Tom.
Yeah.
Let me point out also put the keys on Blackboard. We'll put the PowerPoints on Blackboard.
Yeah.
So the quotes will be there. So you don't have to worry about writing another word.
And I put most of the time, like this one I didn't. I put down the sources, but everything, all the quotes, and tomorrow I'm going to have many, many quotes from Locke, right? But they'll all be there for you to pull out as you need them or if you can use them. All right, so the key here is maturity. It's growing up, right? It's getting over your childish kind of fears, right? The Enlightenment is all about being intellectually mature and dealing with these kind of uncertainties and sort of facing up to them and standing up on your own and thinking for yourself, right? And it's almost like a sense of courage, right? Or it's cowardice not to do that. Right? It's childish. It's like being afraid of your shadow. It's like being afraid of what's under the bed. Right? You have to get past that. That's kind of the model of the Enlightenment. Okay? Have the courage to use your own understanding.
Is this, when you talk about understanding, though, is this a sort of an empirical kind of intellectual? It's not intuitive. It's not the...
No. For him, no. We won't go into Kant here, right? But Kant basically tried to establish in his three critiques, right? At the foundation, the kind of claims you could make in science, like what you can say scientifically, empirically, and what you can't, right? There are certain things scientists can talk about, and there are certain things they can't talk about. The second critique was on judgment, on moral judgment, right? And there's certain things you can say in the realm of morals, what we ought to do, what we ought not to do, right? But you can't say certain things. There are certain limits on what you can know in that realm. And the third was on aesthetics, right, about beauty, right, and what kind of knowledge claims you can make there. So what Kant was trying to do was establish a foundation for our understanding in these different kind of domains, science, morality, and aesthetics or beauty. Right? But he really thought the problem is we have to get clear on what we can say and what we can't say, right? And there are certain things we just can't talk about. Kant had the whole idea of a nominal, phenomenal realm, right? And there's a certain realm, we just can't say anything about it, right? We'll never be able to know that, right? But in a certain realm, the phenomenal realm, we can actually understand things and make kinds of claims, right? But we have to be careful about not biting off more than we can chew or going beyond what we can actually rationally grasp. Okay, so that's sort of the sense of understanding. Make sense? Did I answer it? Okay. Right, but he was really trying to sort of carve out the foundations in different domains of knowledge. And again, that's what he's known for, is those three critiques. This is what we can say in science, but science can't talk about morality. Right? Morality, we can talk about that, but that's very different than talking about beauty. Right? They're related, but they're not the same thing. Trying to get really clear on what kind of claims we could actually make. But the main point I want to make here is, it's this idea of standing on your own two feet and thinking for yourself, and not relying on others. I guess another way to put it is, it's an anti-paternalistic view. Right? Children listen to their parents. Children need to be told what to do. Right? Children want you to tell them what to do. My 23-year-old daughter wanted me to give her directions today. Right? Yeah. Right? At some point, you have to... I should have used Kant. She's a philosophy graduate student. Another opportunity missed, right? Now, speak for yourself. Okay. But, you know, don't turn to your parents. Don't turn to a priest. Don't turn to an authority figure. Don't turn to a political leader, right? Think for yourself, right? That's courageous kind of rationality. Right? That's what the Enlightenment's all about. And I would say most of our founders were influenced by that. Not all of them, right? But they had that kind of, that was kind of what was going through intellectual air, right? That was the milieu in the, which in what they were thinking. And it affected all of them. Okay. Liberalism in that broad sense is a response, a political response to the Enlightenment. Right? It's kind of like an enlightened political attitude, and it comes right out of the Enlightenment. So here's where it gets a little confusing. But maybe it won't be, I don't know. The first distinction I want to make is between classical versus contemporary liberalism. Classical liberalism really starts in the 17th century. It's a 17th century phenomenon, and there's disputes about who was the first, right? I like Hobbes, right? Set 1650s, mid-17th century. Hobbes, I think, was, to my mind, clearly a liberal. Right? You won't think of him as a liberal. You think of him as a proto-totalitarian or something when I talk more about him, right? But he really was a liberal, right? But it wasn't just Englishmen. I mean, Locke is the most famous, and that's what I'll focus on. Hugo Grotius, the Dutch statesman, right? Classical liberal, right? Samuel Pufendorf, a Prussian, classical liberal. It was all throughout Europe, right? This kind of liberal attitude, okay? That's classical liberalism, right? It has nothing to do, well, it does, has a lot to do with it, but it's not the same thing as, who said FDR? FDR, right? That's welfare liberalism. That's kind of a 19th century, 20th century in the United States phenomenon, right? That's contemporary, right? We may call them liberals, right? And they are, right? But so is our right-wingers like Newt Gingrich, Ronald Reagan. I don't know about Mitt Romney. It's hard to, I don't know. Maybe, right? But they're all liberals, right? Our conservatives and our liberals, they're all liberals in that classical sense, right? They all come from that tradition, right? Okay. So everybody clear on that? Yeah.
When I teach about Hobbes, there was an article I read about Hobbes. He might have said it in Leviathan, said that people were naturally wicked and you couldn't trust people.
Yeah.
When I see those views, I don't think liberal.
No.
That's why when you say...
Yeah. But he did say, this is how people are, right? The only way to get out of that, we'll talk more about Hobbes in a minute, right? But out of that state of nature is, right, individuals have to make the rational decision to form a social contract and get out of the state of nature, right? And it's up to individuals to understand it. And he thought they would, right? He said they're wicked, they're passionate. Right? They're vain, right? But they're also reasonable, right? And they balance these two things, okay? But it all starts from individuals consenting to forming civil society. It doesn't come from God. It doesn't come from the divine right of kings. It comes from passionate, wicked people like yourselves, right, who are also rational, right, making decisions to create a civil society. Right? So in that sense, he's liberal, right? But then his Leviathan is like, you know, very powerful and awesome, right? And doesn't have to, there are no limits, right? That doesn't sound liberal either, right? So he doesn't really represent what we would think of as a liberal, but I think he basically takes that Cartesian view. He's a contemporary of Descartes, and he applies it to society. He says, we have societies all over the place. We think we understand them. We don't know. Let's break it down, right? Let's get down to the basic parts, right? Human beings are parts of society. Human beings can be broken down into their passions, into their reason, their ability to understand natural law, right? And you start, and you build up from that kind of understanding what a person is, to society, to government, forms of government, right? And constantly going back and making sure you're not assuming anything, right? So it's that same kind of approach to building up a political theory. And he's really the first one to do that, because Descartes actually said you can't apply that Cartesian method to the soul, to the mind, right? Hobbes did. He started saying we have passions, he listed them, we have reason, he started taking the kind of our free will and breaking it down to these components, right? Where Descartes said, no, this works for the body, it doesn't work for the mind or the soul. Am I getting... So when you ask questions, then I sort of go... But I'll come back to all this on Hobbes in a minute with a slide. Yeah. Well, they'd have to qualify. They'd have to say, okay, but I'm a classical liberal, right? And they'd start citing people like John Locke, right? And Adam Smith, right, who are liberals, right? They're not, so that's what they would have to sort of make that. But they probably wouldn't. They probably would be very uncomfortable because, you know, from that point of view, liberals are kind of a pejorative term. Nah, I don't know where Teddy would go. FDR definitely would be a welfare state liberal. Yeah, but I think really, I mean, in the United States, and this may be offensive, right, but our whole political ideological spectrum is locked within liberalism. I mean, no, I shouldn't say that. I mean, we have some kind of extreme right-wing movements which sort of go off and make colonies in Idaho, right? That's not liberalism, right? But I mean, the mainstream political discourse, in our, you know, no matter how conservative a person is in our political system, they're probably talking about individuals, property rights, free markets. That's liberalism. Right? That's liberalism. That's what Locke wasn't talking about the free market so much, but Smith was, right? But that's their ideas, okay? So I think they have trouble with it, but I think it's an accurate representation of them. You losing me? Oh, okay, all right. Is everybody's good on that, though, the contemporary versus classical?
I think
Gingrich would, because Gingrich is a... Gingrich is an academic, and he actually, you know, I mean, so he would understand that, but he would lecture you about law. Conservatism, contemporary conservatism really is kind of neoliberalism. You may hear that phrase thrown around today a lot. Neoliberalism is people who were pretty much want to peel back the welfare state, let people sort of take care of themselves because they're rational individuals, so like, why worry about Social Security? You invest your own money for your own pension, and that's a better way to go. You don't need the state telling you where your money should be invested, right? That's neoliberalism, right? That's contemporary conservatism, right? But it really is kind of it's really almost a pure form of liberalism. You know, it goes back before the welfare state to what in 17th and 18th century they were talking about. Okay. Is everybody clear on how you could call that liberalism? Yeah? Okay. And classical conservatism, you don't really find much of that in our political system today. There are, and I said this last year too, I'll say it again, it's on tape. We used to have a colleague of mine at Concord, Mike Federici, who's now at Mercyhurst College. And Mike Federici is a conservative, but he's no liberal, not even a classical liberal. He's a paleo conservative, right? Which means he thinks Edmund Burke was right. Modernity is the problem. Right? Letting people think for themselves. That's why we have gay marriage. That's why, you know, I mean, this is what it's gotten us, right? Not that I've opposed to that, but that's, I think, what he would say. But a paleoconservative really wants to go back to almost like a pre-modern form of society, right? Where people didn't question as much. They weren't as skeptical, right? They accepted authority. Right? And I'll give you other examples. There was somebody at Concord who was also paleoconservative before I got here. I actually replaced him, right? This person used to drive, I forget what state, south of West Virginia, to go to Latin Mass, a Catholic. But he said Vatican II was the problem, right? Once they got rid of Latin, right, and everybody could understand the Mass, right, and the priest turned and faced the congregation, right, that's when the Catholic Church started falling apart. Let's go back to the traditional Latin Mass where you look at the priest's back. Okay. So that's classical conservatism, right? There aren't very many people like that around there. They're fun to be around, though. I mean, there are, I mean, because they have a very different... One example, Magic Johnson, you know, Magic Johnson what year he announced that he had HIV, right? I won't mention names, right? But, you know, people were saying this and that about it. He was just like, nobody will say what's going on here. It's sin, right? He was unfaithful to his wife. It's sin. That's what's going on here. Most people are like, wait a minute, you know, it's just from generosity. But, you know, that's that kind of point of view. It's like nobody wants to say what's really going on here. That point of view is really not well represented in our political system.
I have a question. I've heard fascism being described as being illiberal.
Yeah.
Where would you put that in?
Yeah. Well, personally, I think fascism gets thrown around way too much. It's a way to sort of slam anybody you don't agree with, right? I mean, no, it is. It's like... Yes, right. I think it is anti-liberal, right? They want the state over the individual. Individuals should be sacrifice their rights. Businesses should be basically controlled by the state, and they should work for the interests of the state, right? So fascism is definitely its own unique ideology, right? But the state is first. And you can tie that in with racial theories like Hitler did, right? But that comes over individuals and over individual liberty and individual rights. You know, if you're mentally defective, we're going to sterilize you for the good of us, right? That's an illiberal or an anti-liberal perspective, right? And they were clearly anti-liberal. They also thought, right? De Maistre, the other conservative I had, he cited more than Burke for them because he had kind of a racial understanding. But that's where that, and I'm not saying classical conservatism leads to fascism. I'm not saying that, right? But other people would say that, right? No, but fascism is a particular type of ideology, but it's a reaction against all this kind of individualism. Okay, good question. Yeah.
So did you make an argument that
Yeah. You can make an argument that other groups today, which are fearful of modernity, they would hate to hear that, but I mean, they take an almost classical conservative position. They don't want... They want to have a tight moral code that everybody abides by. They don't want to encourage people to think for themselves. Right? They don't want to have religious diversity. They don't want to have independent political thought. Right? Those things are dangerous. Right? And they don't want the materialism of Western culture. You know what I'm talking about. Right? Islamic fundamentalism is kind of like an anti-modern point of view. Right? They see the problems you get with modernity. And again, I'm a thin icer. I'm not trying to simply... Right? But it helps as an example, though. Right? I mean, you want everybody to sort of abide by the Quran. Right? And one reading of the Quran. You don't want, like, everybody should be his own imam. Right? I mean, you don't want everybody reading the Quran the wrong way. You want our reading of the Quran, right, for fundamentalist Islam. Not all Muslims, obviously. But that perspective is kind of like almost a classical conservative position, right? Because society gets too fragmented. Then all traditions start to fall apart, institutions fall apart, and it can be, you know, disastrous.
Well, I was just going to ask, is there on the so-called left?
Yeah. Yep, and a lot of them will basically blame neoliberalism, right, which is the global form of liberalism, right? I mean, you have that global markets. Most countries that want to get involved in the global economy have to peel back their welfare state, have austerity programs, right? I mean, so they point to that as neoliberalism, and that's what they're opposed to, right? But yeah, that root of that position they're opposed to goes back to these ideas. Yeah. Good question. So this isn't as confusing as I thought. Good. I'm just confusing. Yeah, it does, but yeah, I guess. It definitely has that openness to change, right? Because the things, people are fundamentally reasonable, they'll be able to deal with this, right? I mean, I find it in another area, that kind of enlightenment attitude, that kind of liberal attitude, when you talk about environmental problems, right? And I think that the epitome of that approach is, we'll figure a way out through science and technology. And don't worry about global warming, right? We'll figure out a way to sort of live underwater. We'll figure out a way to deal with these problems. Have faith, right? We've overcome famine. We've overcome infectious disease. We'll overcome Alzheimer's. We'll overcome global warming. We'll figure it out, right? It's that kind of enlightenment optimism that, you know, if we just think for ourselves, we can sort of sort through these things and come up with reasonable claims we can build on, right? So it takes lots of different forms, and it really shapes our culture, especially American culture. I think the Europeans are right when they say America is a fundamentally liberal culture in that classic sense. I think that's exactly right. Right? I mean, we really are. I mean, I think you think of the Bill of Rights especially, right? All those individual liberties, right? Freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of association. It's like we trust people to sort of, you know, that most of the time they will make good decisions. Okay. So it's a powerful doctrine, but it's a very radical doctrine too, and it's very revolutionary. And you have to realize most of these liberals, classical liberals, were terrified they were going to be persecuted. Right, for their ideas. Now they seem, you know, I mean, Newt Gingrich and Ronald Reagan are spotting these ideas, but at the time, you know, everybody should own property. You know, as an aristocrat, I find that appalling. Right? We should consent to our government as the king. I find that appalling. Right? They were very radical ideas, but now they become just kind of our background. Okay. All right. So liberalism in the 17th, 18th century, just going to go through kind of broad strokes tonight. And give you a couple of different kind of theories to compare them to see how diverse it was, because I want to make it sound like it's a monolith, right? I mean, classical liberalism had lots of diversity within it, but there are certain kind of stable features. First one is almost all of them, to a man and its men at the time, relied on the state of nature arguments. Right? They all basically took that approach. Grotius, Pufendorf, Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, all of them used state of nature arguments. Right, which are basically kind of like a thought experiment where you basically assume there is no society, there is no government, there are no laws, right? And some people push farther than others. Some people say there's no language, like Rousseau. But you peel away all those kind of social and political and cultural things we've acquired, right? Take those off, right? And then take people, put them into this kind of petri dish, right? This pure state of nature, right? And then see how it would play out, how they would get out of that into civil society. Right? And none of them were saying there is a state of nature. Right? There was a state of nature. It's a thought experiment, really. I mean, Rousseau did talk about the American Indians, and some did point to the American Indians as maybe being a you know, a state of nature, right? But for most of them, it was just like a way of trying to get a handle on all the different ideas that were floating around and sorting them out. And the idea was, let's put aside all the things we've come to believe, right, and start from scratch, right? Just take a human being as we understand them, drop them into the state of nature, and see what happens. And to my mind, the best image is like a Petri dish. My wife's a scientist, right? I mean, you want to figure out a disease, you take it, you put it in a pure environment, right, and then you watch it sort of grow into this disgusting mold. And that's civil society. Okay. But they all relied on that, that trope, that model, right? It was just throughout Europe. Okay, so it's just a heuristic device. They all relied on natural law and natural right. Yep. Like a teaching device. It's just like a, help me here. Yeah, it's a way to illustrate and flesh out a point, right? So I could argue for limited government, right? But I could also say, in the state of nature, this is what human beings would be like, right? And this is the problems they would face, and they would respond by creating a limited government. That's how the arguments all went. Okay. But yeah, again, if you're familiar with this, you know they had very different views of the state of nature. They didn't agree. Right, what state of nature was like. I mean, for some it's terrible, for some it's blissful, you know, and they're all liberals, right? But they all said, we have to start with this idea of a state of nature. Somebody had, no? Okay. So I'll say more about natural light and natural law tomorrow, especially with Locke. But they believe that humans have the capacity to rationally understand certain universal truths, right? Not just about the physical world, like gravity, right? Right, but about certain guides to behavior. Right? Certain guides for human behavior, how we use our free will. There are certain guides out there in the natural order of things, right, that can help us, right? And reason is what allows us to recognize those, right? The passions get in the way, right? If I'm angry, I may not act reasonably, right? But when my passions are kind of quelled, right, reason allows me to see what's right and what's wrong, right? And that's sort of written in the order of things, right? So an assumption of all these people, and again, Hobbes is the one that's most tricky, but there's got to be some kind of authority behind those natural rights and natural laws. Right? There's got to be something kind of behind it. It didn't just happen. Okay. Social contract leads out of the state of nature into society. Right? I mean, you have to get out of that state of nature into some kind of social arrangement. And the view is, and think about this, though. I mean, if you think about contemporary conservatives, free marketeers, the model isn't an inheritance. The model isn't something that was passed down by your grandmother, right, which is what Burke would say. You know, we get our institutions because they're handed down by our ancestors who we revere, right? For them, it's a contract, right? And think about that, a contract, right? You do this, I'll do that. You give me this, I'll pay you that. That's the model for how society is founded. It's a very capitalistic kind of concept, right? It's a social contract. It's not an economic contract, but it's that, like, promise and fulfillment of the promise and the obligation to make to others, right? That's how you form civil society, right? And I just want to, I don't know how to make this point, right? You have to realize, they're all talking about this. It's not just one crank out there. It's like Dutch, the French, Germans, Englishmen, they're all talking about this contract model for getting into society. So you can see why this fits in really well with contemporary conservatives who are free marketeers. Right? It's all about contracts. It's all about you taking care of making a deal, right? Making Donald Trump. I don't know what Donald Trump is. But thankfully he's not visible. Okay. And the belief then, though, is that natural law, once you get out of the state of nature, it still governs civil society. Right? The order is based on natural law. Right? I don't know what you people think about natural law, but it's an idea which has gotten kind of beat up. I don't know if you, how old you guys are. When Clarence Thomas was being nominated for the Supreme Court and defending himself, what's the word? Being evaluated, right? Yeah. He said, I'm a natural law jurist. And people were, at the time, were like, what the hell does that mean? You know, I mean, it's not that obvious to me what reason would require. Does that mean he's like, what does that mean? I'm a natural law jurist, right? I mean, in the 18th century, in the 17th century, you could pretty much understand what that would have meant, right? But we're so diverse today, it's like, what's he trying to say here? What's that code for? Because we don't really think there's like, we all agree on natural law. I mean, some of us are opposed to, say, gay marriage, right? That's unnatural. Other people think it's the most natural thing in the world, right? So what does natural law say about that? Clarence Thomas probably has an answer, but I mean, okay. Got this, like, this model, though? Okay, so I'm going to give you some examples of it. Hobbes, who I've mentioned, and you mentioned. Hobbes is one of the earliest. Grotius was a little earlier, but Hobbes is one of the most influential liberal thinkers, political thinkers. His state of nature, he basically describes it as a state of pure equality and natural right. Okay? Meaning, everybody's pretty much the same in the state of nature. Nobody, and this is almost a quote, nobody is stronger, so much stronger or wiser than anybody else that they can expect to maintain a long-term advantage over somebody else. Okay? We're all pretty much equal. I may be a little bit smarter than you, but you're a little bit stronger than me, right? I may be faster than you, but you can throw a rock a lot farther than me and hit me as I'm running away, right? So nobody's got that big an advantage, right, that they can set themselves apart from anybody else, right? Right? They're all pretty much the same, and they all have a natural right. Okay? And the natural right for Hobbes is the right to preserve yourself. That's what the natural law teaches, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But for all these people, Grotius, Pufendorf, Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the law of nature is self-preservation. That's what it means, right? Everything that's alive preserves itself. Flowers turn to the sun. Their roots go toward water, right? Animals flee danger, right? They go toward food, right? Everything strives to preserve itself. So that natural law of self-preservation is in the state of nature, and that, from Hobbes, that means everybody in the state of nature is equal. Everybody has the right to do whatever they think will preserve themselves, right? If I think that means taking your purse and rifling through it, fine, right? If you think that's wrong, you can whack me, right? But there's really no right or wrong here, right? I do what I think will preserve myself. That may get me killed. It may make me get a temporary advantage, right? But that's what it is, right? And he said there's really no right and wrong here. I have the right to do whatever I think will best preserve myself in the state of nature, because we haven't agreed on any kind of social contract, right? So I can't say murder is wrong, right? I know the natural law says I preserve myself. If that means in this circumstance I want to take your possession, I have the right to do so. So it's kind of a nasty situation, okay? There is no property. This is crucial. This is why contemporary conservatives, neoliberals, or classic liberals in another sense, right, they don't cite Hobbes, right? They cite Locke. For Hobbes, there was no property in the state of nature. All you had is possessions, right? You better hang on to that purse, right? Because you can't say to me, you shouldn't take that. It's mine, right? There's no property, right? If you can grab it, fine. If you can hang on to it, fine, right? But I have the right to take it if I think I need it, okay? So there is no such thing as property rights, okay? That distinction clear? Possessions is what you hold. Yeah, right, yeah. Kind of, and I think that's why people go, I mean, they go to areas where they can be left alone, right, and they will take care of themselves. They don't really rely on the police. They will do what they think will best protect their situation. So in that situation where there's no property, you just have possessions, everybody has the right to do what they think will best preserve themselves. In the state of nature, it says leads to scarcity, because we're all trying to sort of survive. And once you get into that situation where you think you need that cell phone to preserve yourself, I think I need that cell phone. There's only one there, right? You and I are going to compete for it, right? But he says, part of what people are comprised of is passions, and the most volatile passion is vanity, right? And that is, I want that cell phone, you want that cell phone, right? But I think you should defer to me because I think I need it, right? And you feel the same way. And he says, it's that kind of vanity which leads from this competition for scarce resources to, we're not even arguing about the resources now, it's like, back down, I want the phone, right? And you have these two vain people sort of basically making demands on each other that they should respect the claim of each other, but you should respect my claim. I don't have to respect your claim. That probably didn't come out very clearly. Is that making sense? Right. He just says it escalates, right? You have competition over an apple, right? And then it's not the apple. It's like, back down, right? I was here first. It's my apple. It's like, no, you back down. And that vanity is what escalates to the point where they get involved in violent conflict, right? So consequently, for Hobbes, the state of nature is, nobody knows this famous, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, not prudish. Somebody at Concord wrote that in an exam. Prudish. I'm like, ooh, no, it wasn't prudish. Brutish and short, right? The state of nature is a war, or a potential state of war. You never know when somebody's going to take what you want, right? Take what you have. I think I used this example last year, but I'll use it again. When I was teaching this once at Concord, a student was from Richmond, Virginia, which at the time was the murder capital of the United States, had very, very high level of crime. And this student, actually, Terry, heard this and he goes, this is like Richmond, right? It's all about respect, he said. It's all about respect. It's like, you know, if you don't give respect, all of a sudden it's like you're in a fight, right? You have to back down or you have to defend yourself, right? You can't turn to anybody else. And he said, you know, and I'd never really thought of it that way, but it's kind of like, yeah, that's what Hobbes is saying. It can always end up that way. It's not always like that, but you never know when it's going to turn into like me against you. And, you know, one of us is going to have to back down, right? But I think you should, because I think so much of myself, you should respect me. So he thought it's a terrible place, the state of nature. Nobody would stay there if they could get out of it, right? And once you get out of it, you're not going to do things which will lead you back to that state. right? I mean, okay. So what gets you out of the state of nature is first, reason. The laws of nature, the first law of nature is self-preservation. The second is seek peace and find others that are willing to sort of make sacrifices or sacrifice some of their freedom along with you in order to maintain peace, right? That's what reason tells us, right? But when I'm pissed off at you about that cell phone, I can't recognize that. That's the problem, right? I understand it, right? But now I'm offended because you won't back down. So now I want to smash you with a rock and take your cell phone. Okay, that's sort of how it plays, right? So you have this constant balance between passions. Okay, so you're getting Hobbes' state of nature. That's a liberal point of view, in this sense. Okay, but also I should make this point. The other passion, though, which really leads out of the state of nature and helps reason for Hobbes, is the fear of death. The fear of death. Right? Now, you have to realize, traditionally, what do people say about people who fear death? Think historically. Think classical Greek stories, Roman stories, the heroes, right? Did any of them fear death?
No.
No, they're all, you know, come on, right? They're all courageous, right? People who fear death were cowards, right? Right? If people fear death, you're not going to have religious martyrs, right? You're not. It's like, yeah, I'll believe whatever you want, right? I mean, you're not going to have religious wars. This is his point, right? People should fear death. There's no reason to fight over these ideas, right? When the Civil Wars broke out, what did Hobbes do? Went to France. He said, you're going to fight over, I mean, call me when it's over, right? Only irrational people would fight over religious ideas, from Hobbes' point of view. He actually argued there's no reason for anybody to be a martyr, right? You have to realize, that's a very radical idea in the Seven Hobbes' point of view. They're trying to get to a safer environment. They're not going to stick around for that. Who knows how it's going to turn out? Right? I mean, so a reasonable person wouldn't get involved in those kind of conflicts, right? But the point I'm trying to make is he didn't see it as cowardice. People thought Hobbes was a very dangerous figure because they said, what are we going to have, a race of cowards? I mean, all the Englishmen read this and they say, fear of death is okay. It gets you into a safe civil society, right? I mean, how are we going to maintain our national integrity? A bunch of cowards that fear death, right? It's a very, very radical idea. He actually embraced cowardice, right? And made it a virtue, to some extent. I mean, it's okay. All right. The upshot, though, is he created a society, and this is why he would say he's not liberal, right? But he thought, because we are passionate and rational, right? You have to have a political authority which is incredibly powerful, the Leviathan, the biblical monster, right? A fearsome sovereign, and the frontispiece of Leviathan had the sword, right? The sovereign has the power to kill, punish and kill subjects, right? And if you violate a law, the punishment will be severe and it will be public, right? So the authority he created was a very, very powerful sovereign who basically doesn't give up anything in the social contract. You all give up some of your freedom, right? As a sovereign, I don't give up any of my freedom, right? I can do whatever I want to preserve myself. If I'm rational, I'm not going to push you to the point where you're going to revolt, right? But I'm going to rule in a very kind of rigorous manner, and I'm going to punish transgressions against my law harshly and publicly and set the tone, right? You don't violate the law, okay? And Hobbes thought, that's the kind of sovereign that we can have a peaceful society. Everybody will obey the law. Everybody will sort of go about their own business, okay? Those who become too aggressive, whose passions get out of hand, they will be punished. Okay. Got that? Okay. Yep.
Well, in essence, the end result is not really much different than
divine rights. Right. Except it comes from rational individuals consenting. And I should say more about the social contract. For all of them, it basically amounts to, I give up some of my natural freedom or my natural liberty or my natural right, as long as you give up the same amount, right? And we create some kind of authority that we all abide by, and then we're all safer. Okay? How much you give up and how little you give up, that changes from liberal to liberal, right? But the idea is, you know, we all give up some of our freedom together in order to create a sovereign which will do a better job of protecting the freedoms we retain. Okay? Right? But for Hobbes, he said, in his model, the sovereign gives up nothing. The sovereign can do whatever the hell he wants. Right? But if he's reasonable, he's not going to simply go around slaughtering people. Right? Because, I mean, eventually people will preserve themselves. Try to preserve themselves in revolt. Right? So a wise sovereign is not going to take advantage of that. Right? Okay. Good on Hobbes?
Either he or John Locke talks about that when they get
past this
point, yep, about what people will do if they're pushed so far.
Yeah,
it's been a year since I read it, but I remember
that. Yeah, Locke actually has the last part of his second treatise is the dissolution of government, when you have the right to dissolve the government. Right? And he basically says you have the right to revolt. Right? From a divine right of king's perspective, that's dangerous. Hobbes would say that was dangerous. He would say rebels can just be Yeah, punished. Okay. All right. But okay. That's a good point. Good? Next, liberal. And this one's the kind of strange one, but again, jumping out of context, so I'm going to go back to Locke. The reason I'm going to stress Rousseau a little bit is because Rousseau's ideas influenced the French Revolution more than anybody else. I mean, his influence on the French Revolution was greater than Locke or anybody else, right? And that's the one that went so terribly bad. Okay? But it's a liberal point of view, but a very different point of view about what the state of nature was like. So this is from a discourse on the origins of inequality. I'm kind of vague on the history of the story. Rousseau made a name for himself because he wrote an essay for a competition about the arts, right? And he won the prize, and he was kind of like a celebrity. And then there was another context about equality. Is it natural or artificial, right? And he wrote Discourse on the Origins of Inequality, and they wouldn't even accept it for competition because his ideas were so far out of the pale, right? So far beyond the pale. They basically wouldn't even consider it. But it's an important part of his political theory. From his point of view, he thought Hobbes, for instance, took a 17th century Englishman, right, with all their kind of traditions, right, and took those people and put them in the state of nature, right? He didn't really pare away enough of those cultural, social factors, right? And he thought he was doing a much more radical job. He says in the state of nature, right, individuals are completely self-sufficient, right? They don't depend upon anybody else. They don't care about anybody else, right? And they have a certain kind of noble dignity, right? They're completely self-sufficient. He says the man in the state of nature always has everything he needs with him at all times. Basically, he takes care of himself. He depends upon no one. Okay? So it's that kind of enlightened idea about being kind of standing on your own 2 feet. But he says that's how they were in the state of nature. They have the right of preservation, right? But they also have an aversion to the suffering of others. He says a natural man, if he saw an animal that was suffering, he would feel compassion, right? He wouldn't want to inflict suffering on somebody else. He'd rather walk away from a fight than get into a fight, especially if there were other resources around. Right? He's not that vain. He's more compassionate than he is vain, right? So it's a very different understanding of what human beings are like. Okay? They have this kind of natural capacity to avoid suffering and not to inflict suffering on others. From his point of view, the problem was as soon as people accepted property, private property, then that noble savage, that kind of blissful state of nature started to fall apart. Right? And it was only a matter of time before you had these kind of corrupt civil societies where he claims everybody lives in chains, right? Everybody depends upon somebody else. I depend upon you for a job. You depend upon me for something. We're all kind of enslaved to one another. Right? Nobody's really free, okay? But for him, the real problem is private property. That's where it all starts. So I'll let you read that quote. And that thing about filling up the ditches, the enclosure movement. You know, where common land was given to private individuals if they improved it, if they put in ditches and fences, right? And his claim was, the first person who basically rejected that would have been a hero, right? Private property is the beginning of the kind of the decline from this kind of noble savage in the state of nature to this kind of corrupt situation we're in today. Okay. So private property leads to interdependence upon one another, civil society, and one of the things, I don't have it up here, but for Rousseau, it really bothered him. His claim was, once you get into these kind of civil societies, which are based on private property, all of a sudden, you can't really trust people to be genuine, to be honest, right? Because now, they want to give the appearance that they are the kind of person others would trust, right? And the appearance counts for reality, right? If you think I'm trustful, you will let me, like I left two electricians at my house this morning, with the door open, right? And hopefully that was, you know, they really are decent people and it wasn't a pretense. But he says now if you get the appearance of being trustworthy, the appearance of being whatever you value in your society, that counts. Right? And all you have to do is basically present yourself in that way, you will get the benefits, right? You can also not be that way and get the benefits of being a bad person. Making sense? Right? So we basically depend upon other people for our sense of self-worth, right? I don't feel good about myself as a teacher unless you people write good evaluations for me. Right? Right? Seriously, so I pander to you, and I tell jokes, and I, you know, I give you extensions. You know, that's how it goes, though, right? So am I really concerned? Am I trying to present myself as a caring teacher so you give me good evaluations because I need them to get tenure, right? And he says society's just full of that all the way through, and he found it kind of repulsive, right? Better to be in a state of nature where I didn't need anybody else. Even the sexual relations, he said, were very, very non-committal. It's kind of like, never mind. They didn't need other people. I mean, they didn't need anybody, and there's kind of nobility in that. But now we've become dependent upon other people, and he really wasn't even talking so much in a physical sense, right? I just don't feel good about myself unless you validate what I feel about myself, right? And I don't feel confident in my own self unless you say, yeah, yeah, you are what you think you are, what you think you are. I agree with you, okay? See, we have a really hard time with our therapeutic culture. So, I mean, you probably say, yeah, look, everybody has to have a talking cure of some sort, you know, because nobody's confident, you know, in their own self-worth. Okay. But anyway, that was the essay which got him in a lot of trouble, because he basically was criticizing modern societies. Okay. His answer, though, the social contract, and this is what influenced the French, was a very different model than Hobbes. His claim was, in order to have, to really be free in civil society, right, the contract has to be one where everybody renounces everything to everybody else. Not a little bit. Like for Hobbes, I renounce my right to punish you for taking my cell phone. Okay? You renounce the right to punish somebody for taking your property, right? And we have Keith, who is our sovereign, who has no limits, right? He will punish you if you mess with my stuff. Okay? That's all I give up. Right? A little bit of my freedom, right? Rousseau's claim was, no, everybody has to totally divest themselves of all their rights. And if we all do it together, nobody's lost anything. Right? Because you've given just as much as you gained from my renunciation. Right? So we're all in the same boat. Nobody's withholding my little bit of freedom. Right? So that complete renunciation is the beginning of his civil society. And then when you make decisions in that civil society, where you've divested your property rights, your religious beliefs, it's all basically going to be decided by the society. You don't retain any kind of private realm. When we make judgments in society, we should all be thinking about what's good for the community, what's good for the society. Not what's good for me, not what's good for me as a part of the society, a faction, which I'll talk about tomorrow, right? But we're all thinking, and imagine this how this way. If everybody was really thinking, like, what's good for the United States? Right? Not as a coal miner or a coal executive or a businessman with global economic interests, right? Or somebody who's a blue-collar worker stuck in an industry which is dying, right? You don't look at it and what's going to help me? What's going to help hang on to coal or steel? Or what's going to help me expand my business empire globally, right? We all think about what's good for this community, right? And we all genuinely try to make that judgment, right? I think this is the best policy for our community. It's a general will. It's what's good for all of us, right? And then you find where the people who are in the minority, they have to accept that they were wrong. Think about that trick, right? It's like, I'm wrong. I'm a millionaire. I really think raising taxes will destroy jobs, right? Most people think my taxes should go up. I have to realize I was wrong. I'm not going to hire an attorney to try to hide my money, right? I'm going to pay more taxes because I was wrong. It requires a hell of a lot of virtue to pull this off. I mean, just think of any kind of example you can think of, right, where you make a decision. Think of your classroom management, right? Right? We're going to vote on this, kids, right? And then everybody's supposed to say, okay, I was wrong, right, because I'm in the minority, right, and not resist, right? Our culture rejects that completely. As soon as you have some kind of legal constraint on what you want to do, what do we do in our culture? Lawyer up. Fight it. Find a way around it, right? And that's not bad, right? That's shrewd, right? Yeah. But anyway, so the general is kind of a tricky idea, but the best point, this is why people really do think Rousseau more than Hobbes is a proto-totalitarian, because he said, the mistaken who don't accept that they are wrong, they have to be forced to be free. You're going to be free in a community where everybody gives up all their rights together. Right? That's the only time you're really going to be free. So if you're in the minority and you don't understand that, right, we have to sort of force you to go along. Right? So he wasn't naive, but it's obviously an ironic concept. But he thought civil society, as he understood it, has to have strong limitations on inequality. You can't have great economic disparity. He didn't say everybody has to have the same amount, but he said if a society gets so unequal economically, materially, that you basically have two cities within one, it'll fall apart. Right? You can't have, these may not be good examples, right? But you can't have like a two-tiered educational system. Right? These are educational opportunities for you and your family, right? And these are the educational opportunities for me and my family. Right? Or job prospects, right? You can't have that kind of stratification or it'll fall apart. So he thought a well-run civil society is going to have some limits on how far things can go, right? And then basically property will be redistributed or people will be prevented from getting so much more than others that they can sort of create two different cultures within one. Okay? So that's clearly part of Rousseau's vision. He also thought there should be a public religion, minimal, not too doctrinal, right? We all believe in the God. We all believe that God will punish transgressions after you're dead. Not much more than that, right? A natural religion, right? But you have to all abide by it. You have to all at least publicly profess that we believe the same minimal creed, right? And then you have to have a public censor. to keep out pernicious influences, right? And his claim was, once you've lost that kind of moral cohesion in society, it's hell to get it back, right? So the censor's job is to maintain it, right? Not to recover it. I'll try to give you an example of this. If you have kids, right, and the kids have choices, and you tell them they shouldn't do something for instrumental reasons, right? I mean, don't do that, not because it's just wrong, maybe it's wrong. It's like, if you do that, this will happen to you, right? How do kids respond to that? Right, they think, oh, that won't happen to me, right? I mean, so you can't have basically the censor is there to prevent those questions from ever coming up, right? You don't expose people to, I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but some new idea, some kind of new political idea, right? I mean, if it's going to be disruptive to the community, you don't let it get started. Right? Once it gets started, and you tell people, oh, you can't believe this, you have to go to church. Here's a good example, right? Why do I have to go to church? You have to go to church because it instills morals in you, right? That's an instrumental reason to go to church, right? So why is it, the kid goes to church, the kid's going to think, I'm going to church to get morals instilled in me, right? That doesn't work, right? They have to go to church because they think it's like, it's not like trying to accomplish something that you've explained to them. You have kids? Does it make sense to you? Right? I mean, you don't want to go through that process, right? Don't even make an option, right? We go to church, right? It's not a choice. I'm not going to explain it to you. And the censor's job in society is to sort of keep those kinds of dangerous questions, dangerous ideas from ever sort of getting traction, right? Once they get traction, it's all over. You can't really recover. That was his claim, right? So again, I think Rousseau, though, I think he was really being satirical of how corrupt our society had become. I don't really think he believed that these ideas would work, right? I think he was just trying to say, things are so bad. Right? In the 18th century, we've gotten so bad, right? It's really going to be very hard for us to actually recover some kind of democracy. Right? I mean, we've gotten that individualistic, right, that it's going to be very hard to sort of ever get back to that. So he painted a kind of a tough picture, right? This is what it would require to really have a free society. Right? Okay. Good on that? Really? You're just nodding to make me move? Okay. Going back a little bit, this is what we'll be talking about tomorrow, like extensively. John Locke, because I think this is probably not contested, right? Locke is the biggest influence on the American Revolution, the American founders, his ideas. Two books, and Keith and I were just talking about this. Nobody reads the first book, the first treatise, but the first treatise is a very radical book because it dismantles the divine right of kings, piece by piece by piece. He just like takes every bit of that argument that monarchs rule because God gave them power, it comes from a lineage from God, and just destroyed it, point by point. Robert Filmer, De Patriarcha, is the guy whose book he went after, right? And he just dismantled every point that Filmer made, right? Trying to get rid of that idea that monarchs rule because of some kind of divine right. Okay, that's the first part, but it's got some really interesting stuff in it. I mean, it's worth reading. I mean, I use it. He actually starts. There you can start. There's a movement in it among the Enlightenment figures, and I'll talk about this tomorrow. Those that wanted to hang on to Christianity, they wanted to make it a reasonable Christianity. Right? They didn't want this mystical stuff, right? Three in one, Trinity, transubstantiation, body, It's like, it's got to be a reasonable, non-miraculous, kind of like distilled rational religion. And you start seeing that in Locke's first treatise because one of the things I think the big switch was in modernity is, how do people get good about feeling, how do people become comfortable with acquiring a bunch of stuff? Becoming materialistic. I mean, all the traditional religions taught against that, right? Give it up. Go to the monastery. Right? Don't be too caught up in worldly things, right? This is evanescent. This doesn't last. Keep your eyes on the eternal prize, pal, right? The car, the Lexus, that's going to rust out. In the first treatise, actually, Locke starts talking about why convenience is okay. You shouldn't be ashamed from a religious point of view to want convenience. And I wrote a book on this, and I found that the key movement for me was Locke was the first one to actually explicitly say that. Christianity doesn't require that you live an ascetic life. It doesn't require that you give things up, right? If we can find ways to improve our condition, God would want us to do so, right? The example he used was pain in childbirth, which is way ahead of his time, before anesthesia. But he said, if we could find a way that women could deliver children without pain, right? That's fine, right? But I'll tell you, when anesthesia was discovered, there was a huge controversy about whether it should be used for labor. Right? It's like the Bible says, you shall bear, you will bring forth children in pain and you will still long for your husband. It's kind of like, boom, boom. It's like Locke saying, no, if you can get like a final? Shit, go for it, right? Right? And that's nothing wrong with that. Don't. So again, what I'm saying is, like, Hobbes made cowardice okay. Right? Locke makes convenience okay. It's like, God wants you to have a remote, you know? I want you to have, I just heard about this, sorry. But you know, I've always said this, you may remember this when I talked, I always say, eventually we'll have like chips in our brains where we're always hooked up. Right? They actually have people now, they're putting implants. They're developing implants where people will be able to sort of access information all the time. It'd be great. I could have answered my daughter's question. I could have liked to, you know. But anyway, there's no religious compunction about doing those things, right? If this improves our condition, fine, right? The way the story went was, we're punished with the fall, Adam's fall. I'm getting way off track here. But I think that first book is cool. The punishment, the sin, Adam's sin, we're all punished, life's a veil of tears, right? And then you die, right? So you shouldn't expect comfort. That point of view gets challenged in that first book. Okay, I'll let that one go. Second treatise, though, then he starts building up his political theory about how society should be structured. And the big point for Locke, which made him popular at the time of the founding, but not so much. It was more limited government, I think. But what makes Locke really popular today is his argument about property. Right? Hobbes said, there is no property in the state of nature, just possessions. You get property in civil society because the sovereign says you have property, right? If the sovereign says that property is no longer yours, it's no longer yours. Okay? Locke made the argument, and Rousseau said, accepting property is the beginning of the decline into this kind of corrupt state we've fallen into, right? Locke said, no, there are property rights, and they're grounded in natural law, and they exist in the state of nature. Before anybody forms a civil society, before anybody forms a government, there are private property rights. Okay? And I'll talk a lot more about that tomorrow, because I want to really take that argument apart, because there's lots of assumptions that go into that, that I don't think a lot of, dare I say, neoliberals, contemporary conservatives would buy. Right? They like the idea of private property, exclusive property rights, but if you go back and look at the whole argument Locke was making, there's lots of assumptions built into that claim, right, that they don't really want to hang on to. Right? I mean, they don't want to sort of accept the whole enchilada, the Lockean enchilada. Okay. And limited government. Government is created, from Locke's point of view, and this is the famous quote, to protect life, liberty, and property. And he says over and over again, we create government to protect the property we naturally have. And there's no doubt about that. He does say that over and over again. And that's the main foundation, main reason for revolting, is when the sovereign starts taking your property in a certain way, then you have the right to start tea partying. You know where I'm going with this. Okay. And then the last is that you mentioned, the right to dissolve government, the right to actually revolt. Take it down. Break it up. Right? But his point was, when you dissolve a government, you dissolve the government, you don't dissolve society. Civil society is there, you create another government to try to protect what you have in civil society. Right? And just think about what's going on in the Middle Eastern countries right now. Right? They're toppling existing orders. Right? And a conservative would say, I think a classical conservative would say, my God, that's going to be terrible. Right? Maybe Tunisia will work. Yemen's going to could be a bloodbath, right? Who knows, right? But a classical conservative, a paleoconservative would say, we shouldn't be encouraging this. This could become terrible, right? A liberal enlightenment figure is going to probably say, no, if people aren't being represented, they have the right to revolt. But from Locke's point of view, and this is what communitarians say, there's got to be a civil society there. There's got to be a society there if you're going to topple the government. You can't just have a situation where there really is no civil society. Right? You just have an authoritarian system, and you topple that, then there is nothing to fall back on. Okay? So Locke did say there is a right to dissolve the government, right? But that doesn't get to the whole society. It just gets to the political structure you've created. The society remains.
How does he get from the natural law to property rights?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
Tomorrow. I can tell you real quick.
No, that's okay.
I can tell you really quick.
I can't bring it out of my mind.
Yeah. So. No, he's got a very elaborate argument, which I think makes a lot of intuitive sense. And it comes up over and over and over again today when you're talking about things like who owns the who owns the polyp that was removed from my colon? Sorry. Sorry. But I mean, this is what's going on. All of our tissues are stored now, right? I mean, there's Yeah, okay. No, but these are like pathological specimens, right? And they turn them into very lucrative commodities, right? There's a case by a guy in California, John Moore, who had his spleen removed for cancer and for leukemia, right? And they turned his spleen cells into the Mohs cell line, which is a very lucrative cell line. They sold it to Sandoz Pharmaceuticals. And he finally sued in court and he said, That's my spleen. And we'll talk more about tomorrow. But the court said, no. That's not yours. It's just waste, right? But they were arguing on Lockean terms. Who does this belong to? Right? Yes, by Skloot, Rebecca Skloot. Yep, and she cites people like Laurie Andrews who cite Locke about, okay. But again, even there, it's if you think about what Locke actually said, it's strange. But we'll talk more about this tomorrow. I love talking about that, but I think it's fascinating, right? Because, I mean, embryos, surplus embryos, all these things are ownership claims, right? And where do we go back to when there's like dispute? Like, who owns that kidney, right? They all go back to Locke. Locke's theory of property. Right? It's the best theory we have, right? Because if there's some kind of property which nobody's talked about before, right, they always fall back on Lockean liberalism, right? So he's really important, so we'll spend a lot of time on that tomorrow, okay? Good on Locke? Well, a lot more about Locke tomorrow. But the point I'm getting here is they're all liberals. Life in the state of nature is nasty, poor, brutish, and short. Rousseau, it's a noble savage, right? You know, men beating their chests and taking care of them. Hatchie said things like that. If you put a noble savage up against the modern, no contest. I mean, the moderns would never survive, right? But these kind of pre-modern people in the state of nature, they would take care of themselves. And then you've got Locke, who had a very different idea we'll talk about natural reciprocity, right? I give as much as I take from you, right? It's almost like the golden rule for Locke, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. The point is, there's a real diversity of opinion about what the state of nature was like, what the social contract was like, what civil society should be like once you get out of it, right? But that's all part of liberalism. And all those ideas, the founders were familiar with all these ideas, right? I mean, they would know them. Okay. Just to sort of back my point up about Locke and the influence, this is Jefferson's take. Locke's little book on government, he's referring to the second treatise, which we'll talk more about tomorrow, is perfect so far as it goes. Descending from theory to practice, the Federalist Papers, supporting the Constitution, right? So Jefferson clearly saw the movement to create a national government and the Constitution as a Lockean kind of, an application of Locke's ideas in practice. Locke. Just to give you an idea that I don't want to, the danger is I'm going to give you a lot tomorrow, and I don't want you to simply accept my reading of Locke. Right? I mean, go back and read him yourself. Right? And see what you can pull out, right? But the perspectives on Locke are all over the place, right? The left, especially Canadians, they tend to demonize Locke. Locke is like the problem with capitalism, individualism, the problem in our society. It all goes back to Locke and the idea of property and acquisition. He's called the possessive individualist by C.B. McPherson, a Canadian political theorist who wrote a very famous book about the theory of possessional individualism. And Locke was one of his main targets, right, for sort of instilling this kind of individualistic, property-oriented perspective as opposed to a community. Contemporary conservatives, neoliberals like the Tea Party, they love him. They love their Locke, although they shouldn't love Locke. They like, there's parts of Locke they can love, right, but there's other parts of Locke they really wouldn't like, I don't think, like the separation of church and state, right? I mean, those ideas came from Locke and through Jefferson, so they don't want to talk about that, okay? And then the classical Republican perspective minimizes his influence. So basically, they argue there were other ideas out there that weren't liberal individualism. They were much more of a kind of a form of republicanism, back to the Greek and Roman model of what a citizen was like, right? And that's what influenced the founders, and that's clearly there too, especially among the Anti-Federalists. And that perspective is there, right? So they say, Locke's been overemphasized. It's not all Locke. There's lots of other important voices out there we have to sort of get into the mix, which I think is valid. Okay. And then others find him as a source for a different kind of liberalism, a different kind of republicanism, a modern republicanism, which doesn't go back to the citizen who will sacrifice for the state. It's kind of a much more, less heroic, less demanding kind of republicanism, right? Just be honest, pay your bills, don't take people's cell phones. You know, don't steal Professor Tierney's stuff when you're in his house as an electrician this morning. That's all we expect from people. We don't expect heroes and martyrs. We just expect decent, generous, honest people. Right? But it's a form of kind of civic virtue. So all those things they get out of Locke. They hate him, they love him. Okay. Talking a little bit about... Okay. I just want to talk a little bit about the Tea Party just because I do think they're raising the issue in a way which nobody else has. Right? I mean, they really are kind of hitting buttons that I think are legitimately things the founders were really concerned about, right? Which doesn't mean I think they're right, because I don't, right? But I think it's important to understand. I mean, that's the foundation for their claim. So these are all from their mission statement, the Tea Party mission statement, the website. So I'm not trying to, I don't think I'm misrepresenting them at all. And these are quotes, okay? So the mission statement is, they're worried about government spending and taxation, They want to mobilize citizens to secure policies that are consistent with their values, fiscal responsibility, limited government, and free markets. Okay. And that's the basic foundation. And I don't think, and I don't know if anybody ever how close, I don't know how much they endorse the idea of kind of a Christian nation. I think some do. I'm not sure if all if that's part of the Tea Party. It's not really on their literature, right? But I think a lot of people in the Tea Party do think that. You know, we have to sort of maintain that Judeo-Christian foundation. But the core values, I think, are very, very liberal. Fiscal responsibility, limited government, which is Locke's idea, and then free markets, right? Individual property, okay? And they also say they believe in natural law foundation, which I think is interesting. So this is kind of repetitious, but, I mean, I underlined the part where about the natural law foundation for property rights. Okay. And I guess to my mind, I'll let you read that. So I think if there's a natural law foundation for this, for the Tea Party's perspective, I think that presupposes some kind of moral, I mean, sociologists call it a conscience collective, right? But a shared moral view, right, which would allow us to all recognize the same thing when we look at natural law. Okay? And the foundation for that, I think, you know, where does that, what's that grounded in? Right? That kind of recognition. And that's why I think a lot of them, when push comes to shove, they end up wanting to have some kind of religious background for those kind of beliefs, because natural law requires that kind of foundation. Okay, making sense? I mean, if there is a natural law written in the order of things, right? How did they get there? Is it just like, I mean, and it's, most of the arguments fall back on some type of source for that kind of law, that kind of right, which is why I think a lot of it presupposes the idea that there's kind of a shared moral sense, which is a kind of Judeo-Christian tradition. Right. But a lot of people, I think, on that population that the Tea Party would appeal to are fearful we're losing that. Okay. Is that fair or is that unfair? I'm not trying to say it's wrong. Right? I'm just trying to say I think if you really do have a natural law kind of foundation for all these things about individualism, right? I think ultimately you have to sort of, there's got to be some kind of coherence among us. Right? And where does that come from? Where does that come from? That we all recognize that this is what's reasonable. This is what the natural law says. And I think it sort of pushes them in that direction. Or let's put it this way. I think they have to explain the foundation for it. If it's not that, what is it? What allows us to say we all should recognize this? You should recognize that gay marriage is... You should recognize that homosexuality... I keep picking on you. You should recognize that homosexuality is an abomination. Right? It's wrong. It's unnatural, right? You don't recognize it. You want to get married, right? How can I say, well, there's a natural law out there. I mean, how am I going to make that argument to people, right? You know, and why you're so wrong, and we have to force you to be free, not married, right? I mean, what's the foundation for that kind of natural law claim? It's like, that's what I'm getting at. It's like, there's got to be something, right? It can't just be because I said so, because that's like being a parent, right? I said so. I just said homosexuality is wrong. So, right? I mean, that's the Enlightenment's all against that, right? That doesn't work, right? The church says gay marriage is wrong. I'm a Catholic. I don't abide by that. Right? I mean, I think for myself, right? It has to be some way to sort of bring all those points of view back. Right? And I'm at a loss where they can go for except that. Unless you want to beatify Locke. No, that'd be wrong. Okay, good. All right. So that's just kind of like an overview of liberalism. I know I went real fast. Everybody feel pretty comfortable? Okay, so tomorrow we'll pick up the pace. No, I mean, we have plenty of time for questions, though, if you have questions, if you want to clarify it. I mean, and I'm very willing to talk about it. I love talking about it. No questions?
How did we move from that definition of liberalism to what liberalism
has become? Yeah, okay.
Is it called today?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think.
Is it just called it?
No, I think you can sort of follow the trail. I mean, when I teach this, I usually sort of do a diagram. I really think a lot of it had to do with economics. I think, you know, the idea of individual having private property and free markets, but I think we'll talk more about Smith, but I think Smith's free market and the laissez-faire is misunderstood because people think today it's cutthroat capitalism, right? It's bound up with a whole theory of moral sentiments, right? Smith would say a free market only works if people share kind of a moral concern for one another, right? You can't have absolute strangers, right, involved in a free market. It becomes a kind of cutthroat phenomenon. But I really think what happened was private property and a capitalist economy became, it grew and developed, and with the scientific progress that went along with that, fueled it, right? All of a sudden, it kind of changed the nature of society. If you talk about modernity and pre-modernity in sociology, we talk about it in terms of Gemeinschaft, which means kind of like a pre-modern community where people did have a very, really uniform moral code, right? They had a, they were pretty much self-sufficient economically. They all pretty much did the same thing. You didn't have a high division of labor, right? So you had a very, very cohesive, tight community. People helped each other. They trusted each other, right? An example I think of as a pre-modern culture, because I live in Ohio, and in Wayne County, and Holmes County is the county south of us, which has the biggest Amish population in the country, right? I mean, the Amish are a great example of Gemeinschaft, right? And they have their orders, right? They hasn't, you know, they've split because of the Reformation, that damn Luther, right? So you've got different orders, right? But there's, right? Basically, within the order, they all believe the same thing. They kind of abide by the same thing. Although, one of my first experiences in Ohio was Amish girls buying TV Guide at a magazine stop. And I was like, what was that about? And the person said, they're teenagers. They go into town, they take off their Amish clothes and put on their English clothes and party, and then they go back. I'm like, just like me. But I mean, the same thing, right? I mean, they go through the same process. But I mean, you did. They basically, they had been all farmers, right? They helped each other. They all basically were doing the same exact thing, right? They had a very, very cohesive kind of a conscience collective, a moral code they all abide by, right? But modernity changes that, and capitalism has a lot to do with that. The biggest factor from like a sociological point of view, which we haven't really talked about, is the division of labor. Right? All of a sudden, jobs get broken into little bits and bits and bits and bits and bits and bits. Everybody needs each other. They depend upon each other. An Amish farmer can take care of himself pretty much, right? And he has certain needs, but I mean, to some extent, they take care of a lot of their activity, right? I mean, I just saw a bumper sticker saying, you know, without farmers, there'd be no food, right? You'd all starve. I mean, none of you farm, right? We need you, right? Most of us would starve. We depend upon farmers. That's what Rousseau was saying, right? And farmers depend upon oil companies for fertilizer and diesel, right? And that depends upon the military to get oil. I mean, you know, it's just like we're all, that division of labor, breaking things down, fragments society, right? I mean, I don't understand how a CEO of an oil company thinks, right? I'm a college professor, I mean, this, you know. So we don't have that kind of cohesive view, right? And then you have the state responds by sort of protecting people from that kind of society, right? So you have kind of welfare state protections. Well, we can't have kids working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, right? We can't have women working those kind of hours because they won't be able to have children. Not because, you know, right? And then it gets to, well, we have to protect men. They can only work 40 hours a week, right? I mean, and those things get sort of tacked on because the economy sort of, I think, requires those kind of responses, right? And that becomes welfare liberalism, right? Which maybe goes too far. I'm not saying it doesn't, right? And then the reaction to that is kind of a neoliberal reaction, right? Free markets, goddammit. Get rid of the EPA. Michelle Bachmann, right? The job-killing EPA, right? So they're still fighting in terms of liberalism, but it's just the economy, I really think, from my point of view, led to certain problems that had to be responded to, and the responses worked, right, but then they became kind of contested, right? And then you got Marxism, which develops out of this tradition, which is a very different way to respond to these things. I mean, to get out of that kind of liberal, within liberal, the big tent, right, conservative, liberal in contemporary culture, right, forget about that, let's move to a situation where we really do control things socially for everybody's benefit, right? And that's, again, an anti-liberal perspective, right? But I think our understanding of contemporary liberalism just comes right out of that tradition, and it's just a response to the necessities of industrial production process. It was grinding people up. They needed protection, fouling the environment, right? You need these kind of protections, right? And then we always sort of think it's gone too far. Michel Foucault is a philosopher, a French philosopher, who said the basic question of liberalism is always suspicious about government. Classical liberalism, right? We need government, but we worry about government, right? It's going to go too far, right? We always worry about it. And the Germans, on the other hand, always thought we don't govern enough, the police state, the police Wissenschaft. And he said liberalism has always been about that. It's the same conversation, right? We go too far. We have to pull back. Oh, we've gone too far. We have to pull back, right? Then we need a response. I mean, I see this playing itself out. This is my personal opinion, like with the Social Security. Privatize. Let individuals take care of their own retirement, right? Think of it, you all had your own private pension in 2008 in the stock market. And what would we do? We say, oh, it's the state of nature. Give me that purse, right? No, we'd say we need some kind of political response to help people. People are, you know, losing. Older people are, like, starving, right? And then we go back and we sort of build something up, and then we say, oh, we've gone too far. It's just the same circle. So, again, from a certain point of view, it's really frustrating to be sort of locked in that kind of liberal mindset because it just goes back and forth, back and right? From a conservative point of view, that's stabilizing. You know, we don't go, beep, beep, Max, you know, Mussolini, oh, you know, it's like Newt Obama. Make sense? Right. Yeah, that answer your question? Way too much, I know.
No.
Okay, all right. Any other questions? Yeah, you
hear your question. I want to make sure I got you correctly.
Me either.
Gingrich as a liberal?
Hmm?
Newt Gingrich as a liberal?
Yeah.
So yeah. Why don't we just declare victory and all go home?
again, because we've got these kind of splits. I mean, but I'm saying, like, in the larger historical frame, he's more of a liberal. Nah, Obama's not a good example because Obama sort of moved. It'd be a good example of somebody who's like an extreme. Like Bernie Sanders, when he was a governor, when he was mayor, the independent, right? I mean, he was kind of pushing farther, right? But even he's, I would say, a liberal. But we're all kind of operating in that framework, right? But we have different points of view, just like they did, right? Hobbes, Rousseau, and Locke, they're all liberals, even though they're saying, that's not the state of nature. This is the state of nature, right? We're all kind of in that same umbrella saying, you know, you don't really get it. Government's the problem. It's like, no, people need government protection, right? But we're still having the kind of same context. Nobody's saying, in our culture at least, that the state should control all the industries, right? That the state, nobody's saying that in our culture, right? I mean, maybe in the early 20th century we had more radical ideas, right? But we're kind of in that kind of liberal give and take. That answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. But you think about, what would he value? Would he like private property? Newt? Yeah. Especially at Tiffany's. Ba-boom. Sorry. Right, but I mean, private property, free markets, those are all liberal ideas. He likes that, right? And he thinks that some of the welfare liberal policy has gone too far. Okay. Right? But he's still operating on those kind of liberal premises, right? He's not saying, individuals don't know what to do with their property. We should basically take their property and do things for them. He's not saying that. Okay. Any other? You're going to say something. He's like, you're thinking about it. Like, yes, he's like staring like, I have a question. We'll throw him off completely. Okay. Whenever you want to end it.
Thank you, buddy.
Pull the plug. Okay.
Thank you.
Hand over to me. How do I? Because I got this one.
You were wired.
Now I lose my energy.
That's three cups of coffee.
I know.
I know that's bad, but listen, tomorrow you know. I mean, so if you have slow me down, you ask questions.
And then you go, faster.
Well, but I know, but
Has your mind worked that much in an hour and a half ever? Tom, great, thank you. First thing in the morning, we'll have breakfast and let him have two cups of coffee and let him go. Okay, no. Listen. You know, there's access. The library's open till 10. I mean, I'm not telling you to go there, but obviously, at least you can walk by it and say, hey, it's open. Rest up tonight. We'll be done early in the afternoon tomorrow. We'll have one program after lunch, Keith Lilly. We'll do Native Americans. We should be out of here by 2:30, maybe. How much are you going to do? You're not going to name all the Native Americans, are you?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Did he say 10 o'clock? I thought he said 10 o'clock today. Well, you're right, because last year what he did is they started to keep it open because we were here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.